This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Charles McCurdy, who is professor of history and law at the University of Virginia. He is the 2014 Jefferson Lecturer at UC Berkeley. Professor McCurdy, welcome to Berkeley.
Glad to be here.
Welcome back to Berkeley, I should say. Where were you born and raised?
I was born and raised in Pasadena. My father was a machinist. My mother was just ran the household. I was the first person in my family to get a bachelor's degree, go to college.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
I don't think they shaped my thinking about the world so much as they instilled in all of us some drive. They were very hardworking people.
And was there discussion around the dinner table or in the family about world affairs, about law and society and so on, or not?
No, it was mostly about baseball.
Well, that's a good way to prepare for understanding politics. What about at school? Any teachers before you went off to college that really impacted your thinking?
None that really stand out looking back. They were all good. They were solid. I went to public schools in Pasadena, and they were quite good.
And so where did you do your undergraduate work?
At UC San Diego, which was a brand new undergraduate college then. It's now 27,500, but when I went there, there were only 2,000 in undergraduates there.
And as an undergraduate, is that where you decided to become a historian?
Well, it took a while, but by the time I'd graduated, I was at least thinking seriously about doing history.
And any teachers or professors that stand out when you look back now at sort of influencing your perspectives?
Well, I think the teacher I remember best from being an undergraduate was Herbert Marcuse, who was in the philosophy department and taught a course called Theories of Society. It was a very challenging course. It broadened my view of most everything. And I think I probably worked harder in that class than I'd ever worked in an academic endeavor before, and I enjoyed doing it.
Is that where you first got a sense of kind of the interface of politics, society, and law, or did that come later?
Politics and society, but no law.
No law.
Law came really much later. I think if you'd asked me when I was a sophomore, what do you want to major in, I would have said political science. But there was no political science department at UC San Diego. And in fact, I transferred to UCLA in 1967, and they said, well, if you have to come to summer school, and then we'll admit you for the fall term, and you can major in political science. And I went to UCLA that summer, and I hated it. Mm-hmm. It's just too big. And so I went back, and there was a new guy on the faculty, a recent PhD from Yale, a John Blum student named Michael Parrish. And we bonded then. We're still good buddies today. He directed my undergraduate thesis, really got me interested in history. And he is the second most influential undergraduate teacher I had.
And then you went on to do graduate work and get your degree at San Diego also.
That was really something of an accident. I graduated in 1970, in February of 1970 was the very first lottery for the draft for conscription. And I got a very high number. I just assumed after I graduated I would be going to Vietnam. I got this high ping pong ball number, and I had fallen in love with a freshman at UCSD. So I applied to graduate school just kind of on a lark so I could hang around. I could play intramural football, play intramural basketball, romance my girl. And it turned out I really was pretty good at it. And So I did another year, and then that's when Harry Schreiber came to UCSD from Dartmouth, and Parrish said, "Go to Harry," and that's when my capacity to do law and history really took off.
And Harry Schreiber, I should mention, is here at Berkeley and a professor of history and law in Berkeley's law school.
That's right.
And so what then did you do your dissertation on?
I wrote about a chap named Stephen Field. Harry had run into one of his opinions called the Chicago Lakefront case, Illinois Central Railroad against Illinois. And this was a case where the city of Chicago granted to the Illinois Central Railroad the whole harbor of Chicago and then tried to get it back. And current standards of constitutional law at that time said, once you make a grant, you can't reclaim it. And then went back to an opinion of John Marshall in the early part of the 19th century. And Field carved out an exception known as the public trust doctrine that a Berkeley professor named Joseph Sachs, who just recently died, used that same case to create a public trust doctrine in modern environmental law. This was around 1970-71. And I went back and read that opinion, not through the eyes of Joseph Sachs, but through the eyes of Stephen Field, and figured out that what he was really trying to do was, across a whole wide array of doctrinal categories in constitutional law, to draw really strict and immutable boundaries between the public sector and the private sector. And so this was a private sector overreach, and it was the public sector doing something, the city of Chicago doing something it had no business doing.
That is giving away
Something that belonged to the people generally,
right.
The harbor of Chicago. Yeah. At common law, lakes and oceans, private owners, you can only own to the ordinary high watermark. And then the rest of that resource belongs to the public generally. And here was the city of Chicago saying, we don't care about the inhabitants of Chicago. We're giving it to this very wealthy corporation.
And this was surprising to see Field do this, because he was generally perceived as a conservative.
Well, he was a conservative, yeah. But he was a much more systematic conservative than people had led on. In the conventional wisdom in the historiography and in the political science literature was that basically he carried the sword for the railroad companies, and he fought off any interference with their activities. And here was an example that ran counter to that. And if you read enough opinions, which is what I did that semester, you could get a whole new perspective. So that article made a big splash. I was a very fortunate young guy, because the Organization of American Historians actually gives a prize to the best essay by a graduate student nationally. And that essay won that and opened doors for me that might otherwise have never opened.
So in this work, what was it that was your task, to really go in systematically and look at all of his opinions and really see them for what they were? How important was biographical information about him, the political context, and so on?
Well, those two things were important, but the most important thing was to recover the conceptual framework with which Field looked at these issues, so that, and by doing that, reconstructing his conceptual framework, you could get a perspective on any one case, or a bunch of cases, or indeed lots of bunches of cases that you couldn't get before. So basically, it was an exercise in intellectual history in its relationship to political and legal history.
And in the sort of the political way of looking at Field, he was typecast in such a way that you wouldn't get a sense of the fullness of his thinking about the law.
That's correct.
After San Diego, did you then start teaching, or how did you pursue your studies?
Well, at the end of 3 years, you take qualifying exams, And so I took those and passed. Now I just have to write a dissertation. I applied for a fellowship from the Russell Sage Foundation and was very fortunate to get it. That sent me to the Yale Law School for 2 years. And in the first year there, I learned to walk and talk, be a lawyer. I took all the first year classes, property and civil procedure and torts and contracts, and worked on my dissertation. And then in the second year, I taught a course in collaboration with a regular faculty member who was sort of supervising me as I taught, and then finished my dissertation. And then I was in the job market and got a job at the University of Virginia, and I've been there almost 40 years.
What did Yale contribute to broaden your sense of where the law stood in relation to society and politics?
I'm not sure that it changed my perspective on where law stood relative to society and politics, but I was pretty good at society, and I was pretty good at politics, and I was pretty good at history. And then I became a pretty good lawyer so that I could do interdisciplinary work in such a way that lawyers could nod their head and say, this is pretty good stuff, and historians could nod their head and say, this is pretty good stuff. And so that was the, I would say, the secret of whatever success I've had as a legal historian really ever since.
What year did you go to Virginia, and then what was it like there at that time?
I went in the fall of 1975. The University of Virginia had just desegregated 5 years earlier. The first women were admitted as undergraduates 5 years earlier. It was about 35% female and no more than 2% African American when I started teaching in the college there. The faculty in history and in government, there was not a political science department, but government. There was a guy in government named Henry Abraham, who they'd lured away from Pennsylvania. In the history department was William Harbaugh, Merrill Peterson, Robert Cross, people who'd been big shots in the trade from places like Brandeis and Columbia and Connecticut's where Harbaugh came from. Anyway, they were terrific. And they were such warm senior people. They really wanted the best for the young people they recruited, and they helped me grow a great deal. I loved Virginia from the outset.
And was civil rights issues still, was there still turmoil on the campus at that time when
No.
you arrived? It was an acceptance of the changing university in the context of the civil rights revolution.
I'd say even in town, you could sense that the mores weren't all that different in Charlottesville than what they had been in New Haven or in San Diego. It didn't feel like a southern town. Now, it wasn't a diverse place like Berkeley in 1975, although it has evolved to be like that 40 years later.
I like to ask my guests about the skills and temperament of what it is you do as a legal historian, in case students are watching the program. So what do you see as the requisite skills for a historian, first a historian and then a legal historian?
Well, the most important thing for a historian, whether they're doing history of science or the history of the presidency, is curiosity and imagination, asking new questions about old stuff. But in order to get to answers to those questions, which are going to be persuasive to other people, you need some skills. So you can't do the history of science unless you know something about science. You can't do the history of law unless you know something about the law. So curiosity, imagination get you started. The training in the skills you need to do what you want to do, to come up with the right kinds of answers to the questions you're inclined to pose, is really a never-ending process.
What about temperament?
You got to be patient. Doing history takes a long time to do well. So we always argue with deans and stuff that historians are different than physicists. We don't do 4 papers a year. We do a big book every 10 years because that's what it takes to do it right. And so it does take patience. A lot of times it means using scraps of paper from archives that are hardly legible. So figuring out what they say and then figuring out how you can use them to say something new about your subject.
Virginia, for you, was a unique place, or became a unique place, in the sense that there was collaboration with the history department and the law school. I noticed on your vita that you've really supervised an extraordinary number of theses and dissertations, many of them with law students, many with historians.
Right. So when I came, my main job was to be the coordinator of something that was called the Joint Program in Legal History, which had been established before I got there. And this joint program enabled history departments in the history students in the PhD program to take law school courses for credit toward their PhD, up to four of, 14 maybe. And it enabled law students to earn a master's degree on the same day they would earn their law degree without any summer courses, just working really hard. My job was to coordinate that. It turned out it was kind of like managing a baseball team. There were a lot of moving parts, and the idea was to get everybody working hard and keep riding each of those students. And it's been a terrific program. Of my 30 PhDs, 26 are teaching in law schools now, and a great number of the JDMAs are also teaching in law schools now. So they're not finding jobs in history departments, but they're finding jobs teaching legal history and whatever it is they know really well, tax or torts or whatever it is they know really well as well.
And how would you characterize the benefits for a law student or a lawyer to have a historical perspective?
Well, there are really two. One is just curiosity about where all the stuff they've learned comes from and why it evolved the way it evolved. When the big shakeups came, why did they come when they came? They're all fascinated to learn that. But much more importantly is that lawyers, legal scholars have written about the past forever. And this is the program we have at Virginia enables young people to do a piece of scholarship before they begin their professional career. And if they're really good at it, they may decide they want to be a scholar rather than a prosecutor or somebody who advises Wall Street.
Your major book is on anti-rent era in New York law and politics. How long did it take you to write that book before we talk about it? What was your goal there?
Well, my goal was to the basic storyline is a bunch of farmers in the Hudson Valley. Their land tenure was unlike anybody's land tenure in American history. I mean, they owed so many days of work to the per year to the landlord. If they sold the family farm, they had to give a quarter of the purchase price to the landlord. If they didn't pay their rent, the landlord could come and distrain, take, and sell at a sheriff's sale without any further process. Their livestock, growing crops, valuable stuff out of the barn. So these were quasi-feudal, at least, land tenures in New York, and these guys went on, the farmers went on strike. They declared their independence from the landlord. And everybody who addressed the practicalities of the situation said, well, the farmer's argument is persuasive. The problem is that they're was very difficult to come up with a legal means of extinguishing the landlord's interest in the tenant's land. And the rent strike lasted 26 years. That's why it took so long to recover the story in all of its dimensions. Everybody lost. The tenants lost. The landlords lost because they spent more money defending their interest than their interest turned out to be worth. A lot of political careers were shattered. Some pretty prominent lawyers looked pretty silly over this period of time. So it's a story about how law and legal ideas and political ideas interacted to generate a result that nobody liked.
And the years
I thought that was a fascinating story.
Yeah, and the years we're talking about is 1839 to
1865.
To 65. So how does one? You clearly saw a problem which needed a solution, with everybody having the expectation that the problem was solved, and then by the end it wasn't solved. It just disappeared.
Right. Everybody just said, this is the best we can do. Move on.
How did you research that problem? I mean, because this is a long enough period that there were always different reasons for why there was no resolution.
Right. Well, the resolution was going to have to come from the New York State Legislature, which had annual sessions, which lasted generally from January until May of each year. And so I took the big question and broke it down to, well, what happened in the 1840 session? What ideas materialized? And movements toward each solution in each session of the legislature, what sort of legal problems, constitutional problems, did they pose? Who emphasized those constitutional problems or deficiencies in the means that had been discovered that created doubt about the capacity of the legislature to pass such a statute incorporating those means? And then you had to recreate the political context, the political ideas of the majority in the state legislature and of the governor who asked the legislature to act on this problem. So all of those were factors. So basically the story evolves almost year by year.
And this is all about solving this particular problem.
All about solving this particular problem. But that particular problem was intersected with what to do about slavery, what to do about the regulation of banks, what to do about state spending for canals and railroads, because the same sort of political ideas and legal ideas generated in those issue areas also played a role in the issue area about landlord and tenant.
And there were very prominent politicians involved in this. During this period, or at least part of the period, Seward was the governor of New York.
At the very outset of the story, Seward's governor of New York. And, of course, he's Abraham Lincoln's chief competition for the presidency in 1860 and becomes Lincoln and then Andrew Johnson, Secretary of State. Silas Wright was regarded as the most important Democrat in the country, and a very close friend of Martin Van Buren in the 1840s. So, some pretty big names.
And in the end, there's no resolution. And as you studied this landscape, clearly what emerged for you was a sense of the logic of the lawyers and of the legal system, and the logic of the politicians and the political systems, and the interface between them often leads to stalemate or stasis.
It does. It's almost like the stars have to be in perfect alignment before you can get the politicians and the lawyers agree on a particular solution to a particular policy problem at a particular moment in time.
Give me examples of what would confront the politicians as they tried to resolve this, and thought they were going to resolve it.
Well, in 1846, the governor of New York is Silas Wright, a Democrat. He's got a big Democratic majority in both chambers of the New York legislature. He has some ideas for how to solve the problem, and he works those into his annual message to the legislature. One house of the legislature goes to work on the problems. Meanwhile, the other house of the legislature, it's the New York Senate, is working on the problem of the state printer. Now, at that time, the Democrats were divided into two relatively identifiable factions known as the barn burners and the hunkers, conservatives and radicals. And they have such a huge fight over the state printing that the conservative Democrats end up working with the Whigs to subvert the solution that Silas Wright, the governor, has provided for the anti-rent difficulties. they do this so they can destroy his capacity to run successfully for governor in 1846. And that's the way it works out.
And so the problem on the table is not solved because there's another problem that leads to a fight, so you can't build the coalition.
That's right. And the problem on the table, nobody disputes the validity or the utility of the solution on the table. It's just that the enactment of that solution at that moment in time is going to serve the political interests of Silas Wright, and the majority of the Senate wants to destroy him.
So the logic of politics is the story of personality, of timing, of other agendas.
And also of loyalty, party loyalty or loyalty to factions within a particular party, yes.
Now, is this, hypothetically, is this a problem that another political system in another state could have solved more easily? Or would your argument be, no, this is politics?
I think this is politics in America. I think James Madison wanted to make it hard for people to be able to do things in American public life, and I think it still is. We can all think of moments where there all kinds of things got done very fast. 1933 to 1937, for example. But Roosevelt had just huge majorities in the Senate and the House. He had an external situation that everybody agreed was absolutely awful, the Great Depression. And under those circumstances, overcoming some of those other bonds that make American politics so such a difficult, and its connection with the law so difficult to achieve things, were sort of set aside in the 1930s. So how do we do on getting a solution to slavery? Not very good. We had a civil war.
Now, what about the logic of the legal system? It obviously plays into the logic you just described in the political system. But how are the lawyers different in their contribution to the stalemate of this problem?
How is their contribution different than politicians?
Yeah. How do they bring to the table roadblocks that are different from those of the politicians?
Well, because they are very interested in constitutional limitations on what governments can do. So Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution of the United States says, no state shall pass any law impairing the obligation of contracts. So if the legislature just wanted to say, New York legislature just wanted to say, all those old agreements between landlord and tenant are void and unenforceable, that would be, everybody agreed, unconstitutional. See, there had to be other ways that you could massage that constitutional language in order to find ways to get around it. You could use the tax power. You could use the power to regulate what one person could pass to his heirs in the next generation. You could act on the remedies that the landlords had against defaulting tenants. One solution was simply to expropriate the landlords, paying them just compensation, to use the eminent domain power to take their reserved interests in the tenant farm. So these are all kinds of ideas that people put forth. Some of them were more congruent with the attitudes of one political party than with the other. But all the lawyer's task, if that's the right word, was to formulate the legal barriers or obstacles for doing what everybody wanted to do, and then to try to come up with solutions that were congruent with the public philosophy of the of their party. And that's really what the story is, my story is about.
You mentioned one of the founding fathers, and I'm curious, is this problem embedded in an American political culture that really lays a foundation which says, well, we don't want to move too quickly, and we may not want government to do anything in this regard?
Maybe better not to have it do anything than to have it to do too much of the wrong thing. But yes, the separation of powers. Madison said, "Let's have ambition check ambition." He was thinking of departments of government: legislative, executive, judiciary. But ambition checks ambition also between rival political parties. But he wanted the, as he said in Federalist 51, it's great to have a division of power between the national government and the states, because that too can act as a mechanism to check constructive activity, which may tyrannize over minorities. And the whole way the republic works, he said in Federalist 10, by taking in a wider variety of interests, the interests themselves will check one another and make it more difficult for a majority to find common ground. And certainly all three of those things that he forecast as good things for our republic in 1788 were present in New York public life between 1839 and 1865.
How did this problem disappear, or did it, or it was
people
it just
said, we've done all we can, and the controversy's over.
And so now, if somebody buys a property which has this clause in it that they owe rent to somebody, or have to present a pig to somebody who they don't, is that still on the books?
That's still on the books, except all the pigs have been monetized. And the days of work have been monetized. The old quarter sale requirements, where you had to, if you sold your property, you had to pay 25% to the landlord, that was abolished by judicial decision in New York in 1853, which then it opened another door of possible attack by the anti-rent forces, and so that's a whole chapter on how they attempt to say that even the rent is unlawful. So today, people do buy property in Albany and Rensselaer counties, in particular, in New York State, and they owe a perpetual annual rent. It's pretty nominal today. Today, it's probably $40 a year. $40 a year was a lot more money in 1839 than it is in 2014.
Now, it's interesting because this is, in a way, a state/local problem. But in bringing the microscope to it, you're actually giving us a sense of what happens on the national stage. When I was looking at your book, what came to mind was the financial crisis of 2008, where there was so much difficulty in getting any kind of movement that would respond to the crisis. Is that a leap I shouldn't make, that a historian would tell me, no, don't do that?
This historian would say national politics and national public policy are inextricably linked to state, in part because the activities of political parties at the state level set the range of possibilities open to that same party or parties at the national level. But more important, national politics shape state politics in a wide variety of ways. For example, there was a major depression began in this country in 1839. And one of the questions was, well, what do we do about it? And what the Whigs wanted to do was a big flow of money from the national government to the several state governments, which would enable them, the Whigs, William Henry Seward and his friends to use that money to expropriate the landlords and pay off the tenants. They thought they had this thing figured out, and then their president, who they had elected, Harrison, dies, and the vice president vetoes all the Whig plans for generating a huge amount of federal spending that would be dispersed to the several states.
You gave a talk and paper on a classic article written by Herbert Wexler on proposing a theory that in a way consolidated, the article was written in 1954, the New Deal vision of the role of government. Let's talk a little...
Especially the role of the Supreme Court in a certain kind of controversy, whether or not the Supreme Court should ever intervene, should declare unconstitutional an act of Congress in order to protect the autonomy of the several states. That was the question that he asked. And he came up with a general theory as to why Congress's choices should never be interfered with by the Supreme Court.
And the point I would like to draw out of you is so part of the role of lawyers in the national political process requires a foundation in theories of law that draw on existing theories but modify them to support. Or define the work of one branch or another of the government. Talk a little about that. I mean, here is I don't know, where was this article published by Wexler?
Columbia Law Review, 1954.
Yeah. And it's seminal, right?
It's
seminal because, in other words, it draws on bodies of law to frame a new understanding
that was congruent with the understanding already, no theoretical foundation, but there was a general understanding among people in the New Deal coalition that the Supreme Court should not say no to Congress in situations involving the protection of states' rights, that the states could protect themselves.
And to do this, there is a defining of the role of the federal government vis-a-vis the states. I think the term he used was interstitial, meaning that what the Congress is doing, because it's so shaped by the states in who's in the Congress, becomes a way of saying, well, therefore don't interfere with what the Congress is doing, telling the Supreme Court.
That's right. But this interstitial concept for Wexler was important for still another reason, and that is the claim was that every time Congress acts, whether it's on interstate highways or health care, they act against the backdrop of state law. And they tend to act only interstitially, that is, only building on the deficiencies that exist within state law. And therefore, the states and state law provide a major foundation for congressional reasoning. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, what the states have previously done serves as a backdrop for determining what to do now. This, he argued Wexler, creates it means that the burden of persuasion to do something more than is done in the states is always cast upon the Congress of the United States. In other words, he was a very Madisonian guy, saying that that makes the system is rigged to make it very difficult for the Congress of the United States to legislate. And when they do, that's the reason the Supreme Court should defer to their definitions of purpose and legitimacy in adjudicating constitutional controversies in which the rights of states as states are involved.
Now, as a historian, you were looking at the Wechsler argument and really demonstrating the processes that the legal system requires in order to consolidate a political revolution, really, because this is consolidating the New Deal revolution, and then it is drawn on by the courts as it furthers the civil rights revolution that comes later.
Right. So the lecture I gave in 2011 on the Wechsler thesis, what I tried to do is reconstruct the origins of this idea of the states as serving as the political safeguards, the political safeguards of federalism. And I found a realist strand and a functionalist strand to New Deal thought, a political process theory strand of New Deal thought, and an originalist strand of New Deal thought, and showed how Wechsler fused those three strands into a new bundle that was tighter and more persuasive than had existed before. And that's the reason it had served as really the touchstone of the Supreme Court's federalism decisions from 1954, really until the 70s, when some people began to question whether Wechsler had been right, or even if he had been right, whether the conditions of the American polity had changed enough in the interim such that the way Wechsler thought about it should be challenged. So my premise in that paper was that the Wechsler thesis, the argument that there are political safeguards of federalism, which makes a judicial safeguard of federalism unnecessary, that thesis could be used as a lens for looking at currents of American political and legal thought about federalism from the New Deal really to the present.
Is this sort of reminiscent of your original work on Field in the sense that you really have to dig in either to court decisions or to legal theorists' writings as through time they're grappling with a broader theory, so you can't dismiss a piece of what they've done without seeing the big picture. So this is really giving us insight into what courts, lawyers, and legal theorists do.
I hope so. It is the work on Wechsler and the lecture I'm going to read today at here in Berkeley are all in method traceable to my initial work on Stephen Field, in that I try to take the constellation of ideas at work at a particular moment in time serious enough to see how each of the several elements of thought intersected with and created to create a fairly coherent body, and then to see how that coherent body works over time.
Now, the thrust of what Wechsler was doing was to legitimate, I'm saying this as a political scientist.
Oh, he was definitely doing legitimacy.
Yeah, the nationalization and the centralization that were implicit in the New Deal and in the civil rights movement, which followed Wechsler's argument.
I was going to modify that claim a little bit to say, yes, he was legitimating the centralization that flowed from acts of Congress, but at the same time, he was very interested in also legitimating a Supreme Court decision called Erie Railroad, in which Louis Brandeis, speaking for the court, had preserved the autonomy of the states over the common law. And he was trying to do both in a way that reinforced his bigger project, which was to say judicial review of acts of Congress has no place except to protect individual rights, never to protect states' rights.
In the article, you point out that something is bubbling up from the grassroots that suggests a swing of the pendulum the other way, you know, that even as this doctrine is put on the table, this legal theory, there is dissatisfaction which one is finding in the political system. And we happen to be doing this interview on the day when the Supreme Court has yesterday reached the verdict in McCutcheon versus the Federal Elections Board, where this is clearly the pendulum swinging in the other direction. So my question is part of what a historian contributes is an understanding of the swing of the pendulum,
and also the seeds that started the pendulum in that arc in the very first place. Yeah.
And so what the challenge becomes as a more conservative Supreme Court today on Obamacare, on rules for campaigns, and on other matters is trying to come up with a rationale that builds on that seed and then moves the pendulum in the other direction.
That's right.
And the job of the legal historian is to analyze how well a job they're doing?
Not so much analyze how well a job they're doing, but to ask questions, why are they doing what they are doing now? And that a presupposition is that the seeds of what they're doing and why they're doing it now were begun, that germinated and organized into fairly coherent bodies of thought at some earlier date. Mm-hmm. So the historian's first question is, why and when did that certain array of ideas begin to coalesce in a form that we see recognizable in the opinions written by certain justices, say, in 2014? And then there's another question, of course, is what generates the motion of the pendulum? what political, social, intellectual forces were at work to allow those ideas not just to germinate but to flower?
In the lecture you're going to give later today, and this will not be broadcast for several weeks, so we're not taking away from your audience, you look at the Sedition Acts passed by the Federalists and the response of the Republicans, the Jeffersonians, to that act. And again, here is a case where to pass the Sedition Acts, and we should say what they were, the Federalists looked to legal theory to justify what they were doing.
Absolutely, yeah. So they said the First Amendment, which says that Congress shall not abridge the freedom of the press, they said their statute didn't abridge it. Which meant that they had to define freedom of the press differently than we do. But that shouldn't be surprising that they would. That was the 18th century, after all. And so they defined it on the basis of the common law. And the common law had authorized abridgments of freedom of the press of all sorts, so long as, and this is what free press meant at common law, there was no censorship of what was published. They also had an argument why can Congress pass a law regulating the press? There's nothing in the Constitution that gives Congress the power to regulate the press. So they had to have an argument of where Congress got the power to pass such a statute, and not just an argument as to why the First Amendment would have barred it. So I try to explore that package, the way in which the Jeffersonians contested that package between 1798 and 1800, and then what happened to that package or its pieces, component pieces, once the Jeffersonians came into power. And that kind of dialectical analysis of the rise and fall of structures of ideas is something that I really have enjoyed doing my whole career.
Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, this body of ideas, even when the Jeffersonians come in, are not totally rejected.
No.
In other words, for example, Jefferson criticized the concept of inherent powers, which had been justified because it was what other nation states were doing. And he said, "Hey, this will work for me when I want to acquire the Louisiana Purchase."
Yeah. Well, his friend said, this will work for you. And he said, well, I'm not so sure. We should get a constitutional amendment. But if you think this will work, let's go for it. And so he was circumspect, but he nevertheless invoked the very doctrine which he had spent the previous 5 years condemning in order to justify the purchase of Louisiana.
And in the Sedition Acts, it said, okay, you can publish because of the First Amendment, but if you publish things that are not true, then you can be sued for libel.
You can be prosecuted and punished. Yeah.
For libel. And Jefferson's and the Republicans' reaction to that was, this will create a monarchy. So one of one aspect of this that you're describing is that as the legal arguments are embedded in the politics, the way they are characterized is part of the political process, and the criticism can lead to extreme exaggeration. So Jefferson was saying this will lead to monarchy. It will destroy the Constitution. And on and on.
Yes.
So this is another way in which the interface of these two processes help us understand where we wind up.
Absolutely. And surely, if the Jeffersonians really exaggerated a number of points between 1798 and 1800, and they really did, they anticipated the political tactics we see from in our own time. Exaggeration is also still very much a part of the political process. You just have to listen to MSNBC and Fox News for a few minutes.
What are you left with as a historian as you think about current affairs, whatever your ideology is? Are you left with a sense that really things don't change much? Because of the constitutional order, the fragmented system, the structure of the government that was created by the founding fathers, and every time somebody uses an originalist argument, which Wexler did, you know, it just confirms that everybody is agreed about that system. But maybe that system can't help us solve some of the new problems that are emerging.
It might not be able to. Certainly, its capacity for growth and change has been substantial over 200 years. We might not like all the developments. We might not like, as I suggest, happened in the Sedition Act, in the aftermath of the Sedition Act crisis, was that certain ideas which people had dismissed as ridiculous and impossible suddenly became feasible again. So there's always change in the American constitutional and political orders. They don't always lead to the solutions on particular policy questions or to a kind of political culture that we might wish we had in our more utopian moments. So I'm hopeful for the future. I don't suggest that my career of scholarship in any way suggests that problems can't be solved. But it does suggest that it's difficult. And maybe it was designed to be difficult.
One last question. How would you advise students to prepare for the future, especially historians and lawyers, as they deal with, the set of problems they're going to have to deal with?
Well, my favorite admonitions along those lines came from Louis Brandeis, who said, deal with problems in their context. Deal with situations. Get to the bottom of the facts. Don't worry too much about theory. Generate a good result. Be, in other words, pragmatic. And I think pragmatic politics and pragmatic lawyering are to be much more valued than ideologically laden politics or ideologically laden law. The heroes in my anti-rent book are the very fine lawyers who tried to transcend the particularistic interests of everybody, come up with solutions that would work, and to think of ways in which those solutions could be melded in logical ways into the party's public philosophy so it would have a good chance of resonating with the legislators, resonating with their constituents, and getting enacted. The guys I really don't like were in that book were the ideologically driven, politically opportunistic types. Unfortunately, we have many of those, maybe many more of those at work in American politics today than we have of the Brandeis-like pragmatic lawyers and pragmatic policy-oriented politicians.
Well, Professor McCurdy, thank you very much for coming to deliver the Jefferson Lecture and being a guest on our program to talk about being a historian of the legal system. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.